Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
Welcome along to Friday Night Racing with a Difference this week. It's Gerry Gilroy here with you. We broadcast every Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, of course, all of our social channels, and then again at 8 o'clock on a Friday evening on the Off the Ball show on News Talk. If you want to get in touch with us, you can text the show on 53106. But you are very welcome to Friday Night Racing here on Off the Ball, brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie or follow the new Twitter account at HRI Racing. Johnny Ward is with us as ever. Johnny, how are you getting on?
Hello, Ger. How are you? Calling in from Dublin 8.
Very good. I'm here in Dublin 9/3. So I hope you're cocooning well.
Yeah, it's not getting any easier. I got to say, got out to the Phoenix Park there, which is very close to me, earlier today, and it was great to get out. Kind of getting a bit more difficult, and I suppose on the work front as well. You know, it's actually great to have Off the Ball, because as a freelance journalist, this is a tricky time. So I was kind of just trying to stay positive and just kind of hoping that you know, this will end soon. But I appreciate that our problems are very, very small versus some of the others that people have at the moment.
With the absence of racing, it does give us an opportunity to do some feature conversations with legends of the game, and I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome our guest today. It's none other than Richard Dunwoody. He's actually broadcasting to us from Madrid. Richard, how are you?
Sure, very well. Good to talk to you both.
How is Madrid? It's such a beautiful, vibrant city. It's one of my favourite cities in the world. And, you know, to see what's going on there at the moment is heartbreaking.
It's a fantastic city. We've been here. We've been living here 2 years now. And to say I've really enjoyed our time here. But at the moment, it's I have to say, it's pretty grim. We're quite central, not far from the big park, Retiro. Probably it's less than a mile away. But there's sort of a never-ending sound of sirens, basically over the last 2 weeks since I got back from Argentina.
You have young kids, is that right? So you're kind of
yes.
Like the rest of us, trying to come up with ways to keep people busy and entertained. What are you doing? How are you getting through this?
I've been lucky, really. The last 2 weeks have been quite busy. Had a lot of work to do since I've got back. But to be fair, Millie, our little one's been fantastic. She's taken it really well. We've say probably 2.5 weeks now. She's been in lockdown nearly 3 weeks. But the school have been very good as well. They're giving her sort of video classes. She's only four. No, we're getting through it well. I do miss going, like Johnny was saying, you've been down to Phoenix Park. I'd love to go for a run, but the most I get to do at the moment is head down to the supermarket. Probably head out once every day or once every 2 days, and try and choose one that's reasonably far away without drawing the attraction of the local polizia.
Hey, Richard, we're obviously going to talk about racing in great detail, but you know, given exactly the situation that we're all going through at the moment, your love for the great outdoors is something that we absolutely have to talk about. It's kind of it's been made manifest since you retired, just how much you like being out and traveling and exploring the world and kind of seeing beyond these islands where you obviously would have spent most of your professional career. You've been to Afghanistan, you just mentioned Argentina there, you did a marathon in North Korea. You've been to the North and South Pole. I can only imagine how restrictive you must feel and a bit claustrophobic by the current situation.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, you take the situation, look what's going on. You know, we're very, very lucky. And touch wood, we've got our health at the moment. And it's, you know, if we have to spend 4 weeks, 5 weeks inside, it's, you know, it could be a lot worse.
Can I maybe ask a little bit about some of those places that I mentioned there? Not many people have been to North Korea, and certainly anybody who has didn't, I think, go there with the express intention of running a marathon. They might have been forced to run one when they did get there. But what was the story behind that?
Basically, I ran I ran four marathons there, say 2002 to 2004, and came to about 2 years ago, 2018, and had a mad idea I'd be fit enough to go and run another. I thought if I was going to run another marathon, it would be somewhere different. And so North Korea, I did actually want to do a hike there, but as it turned out, it was probably easier to go and sign up for a marathon through a company based in called Corio Tours, based in Beijing. And so when I probably about say 400 or 500 people from around the world went to run it. We had a group that were there for an extra 10 days, and about 15 or 16 of us. So it was great experience. So got over on the Saturday, ran the marathon on the Sunday, and then we had 10 days, went down to the border with South Korea. That was very, very interesting. One of the most volatile or possibly dangerous places in the world. And also just to see Pyongyang, the capital, was very interesting.
I'm totally intrigued by North Korea, Richard. It's a place that I've wanted to go to. One of the dilemmas I would have would be affording it, but another one would be, did you feel any issue with, if you go over there, you're kind of legitimizing the regime, or do you just have to park that?
I suppose that is certainly one consideration. You might think upon those lines, certainly. But you know, I was very interested to see the place. The people there, I have to say, were very, very happy for the guys that we saw. We mixed with them on a Sunday afternoon in the park. But I have to say, walking through the city rush hour, it was quiet. There weren't a lot of cars on the road. There weren't a lot of people on the streets.
Did you get any chance to, I know that you've minders or whatever all the time, did you get any chance to kind of see the part of the country, I suppose, that isn't the showcase capital on your travels to the DMZ or whatever?
We did travel over to the East Coast and passed through the countryside, and it was, you know, it appeared very, very poor, oxen, cattle pulling ploughs. But no, we were, as you say, we had three people with us all of the time. We went to, having run the marathon, they were there, and I was dying to go for a jog out 2 or 3 days afterwards. We weren't allowed out of the hotels. Basically, once we were in at night, 10 o'clock at night, we weren't allowed out until the bus arrived for us the next day.
Did you explain to them what you did for a living?
No. Also with a journalist who, it was organized by these tour company in Beijing, and we did an article when we got back for the Telegraph about the whole tour. So I was concentrating on taking a few images as well.
Were you always a man possessed of the curiosity that is clearly, it speaks to why you go to try these things when you were writing, because your book is famously, it's about obsession, and it's about kind of living, sleeping, eating and breathing racing, and you've obviously decontaminated from that, so decompressed from that entirely, to the point where you need to use all that nervous energy to think about what's going on in the world and to be curious about the rest of the world.
I've been very lucky through racing. I've met a lot of very interesting people, started to travel really 2001, 2003, ended up going to a magnetic North Pole, racing again, a bunch of army lads. And since then, things have gone on, having met David Hamilton Adams, an explorer, and the South Pole came after that. So yeah, I've been very, very lucky since my race, and to have had the opportunity to do all these other things.
The obvious question is, why do you do them? What, like the mountaineer, was it Sir Evan Hillary who went, well, why not? But in your case, what urge are you trying to suppress, or what itch are you scratching when you're racing to the South Pole and losing stones of weight because you're pulling your sled for 15 kilometers a day?
I say if it's there, you climb it. But so the South Pole was, having been to a magnetic North Pole, I set myself the goal then to complete a full geographic expedition, and the South Pole was going to be a lot easier. Nowadays, it's practically impossible to do a full expedition to the North Pole. You'd have to do it in the dark. So yeah, we're lucky to get the sponsors, get the money to pull it together, and hey, why not? You know, it's there. I was in a very fortunate position to be able to do it. I've been very lucky having finished my career, met a lot of people that have been involved in the travel tourism business. Johnny Bielby, his brothers were in racing. He runs a company called Wild Frontiers, and through him, I've led a lot of companies, a lot of tours, a lot of tour groups to different countries around the world, a lot in Central Asia.
When you say you'd have to do the expedition by night now, if you're to do it, why is that?
In the dark, as in basically 24-hour dark, 24-hour darkness. So the Arctic winter now, and from springtime now, the ice has melted.
Basically. Gotcha.
So basically the years of global warming.
Yeah, I was going to. Were you conscious of that? I mean, it's kind of strange that we're in the coronavirus crisis, obviously, and it's kind of come into my mind that, like, if people could come together to fight climate change like they have to fight the coronavirus, it could be quite remarkable, because ultimately it's a million times more important in the long term.
It is, and it just shows what can be done given this crisis now. And we're going to face terrific challenges with climate change over the next 20 years, 20, 25 years. It just shows governments are going to have to pull together and really put a clamp on carbon emissions, and things are going to have to change, as you say.
Richard, it does strike me that you're an incredibly thoughtful person about the world around you. Were you this person when you were racing?
There's only one thing I bothered about when I was riding, and that was the next winner. That was the way it was, you know. You had to be like that, totally focused, you know, making sure you were getting on the right horses. Once you're in on those right horses and the right races, you had to give it as good a ride as you possibly could, and make the least mistakes than any other jockey. So, you know, that was the job then, and nowadays, yeah, it's very, very different.
When that got switched off, when you no longer had to think about the form or understand what the tactics were going to be, or, you know, what word you had to have with the trainer or the owner, and all the politics that was involved, how quickly did you become somebody who could reemerge into civilian life again? What was that process like for you?
I set up a sports marketing company before I retired. It was running 6 months before I retired. Then I had my neck injury. So the last, I knew for about a year before I retired that it wasn't going to be long. Basically, with my C5, C6 neck injury. So I was having to prepare, and I didn't ever want to train horses when I retired. My grandfather did that. My father did that. I didn't feel there was a job in racing I really fancied. So it was always an idea to do something away from racing, outside.
Did you mourn for a little while at the end of your racing career, or had you had enough at that point, given the level of dedication and stress that must have been involved to reach that level?
Yeah, of course, you miss it. You miss it desperately. You miss being part of that weighing room. You know, that was your life. And, you know, one minute you're in it, and next day you're out of that club entirely. But, you know, you have to look forward. It's a big world out there. And, you know, so as I say, it's just been, I've been very, very lucky since I've retired to see all these amazing places and to meet a lot of very interesting people.
Why are you different in that regard? Because you can see that so many people in racing, you know, they don't really see any world outside racing, because that was how they were reared, you know, on day to day. That's all they ever knew. Literally every day of their life, they're around a horse. And even if they're on holidays, they're on their phone talking about horses to people at home. What was different about you, particularly considering that you came from obviously a line of horsemen as well in up the north? Why were you different, where you could, I suppose, see the wood from the trees?
I'm not sure it's the wood from the trees. Some people stay in racing and make very successful trainers, and you know, love their life. I've loved their life in racing, but you know, I just felt that I didn't want to train. I didn't want to be an owner's manager or whatever. So I felt I had to set myself other goals and to see other things. And you know, it's just the way it worked out. A lot of footballers, they stay in football. A lot of rugby players stay in rugby coaching, whatever, and love it. And yet others will go, you know, down a different route. I think it was Andy Ripley. He was, you know, great rugby player. But after he retired, I hardly ever went to watch a rugby match.
Will you tell us about your granddad and your dad and what that was like? The growing up in that environment and just how much of an influence that would have been on you becoming the jockey you became in the end.
Yeah, my father trained up the North George and trained near Belfast shortly after I was born. So I basically grew up on a pony and watching him ride out with the string. And basically from the age of 4 or 5, all I wanted to do was ride horses. I think I started watching the National maybe 4 or 5. And dad in the end, he always used to go to a point-to-point that day, a local point-to-point. And in the end, I refused to go to it because I wanted to watch the National on television age sort of 5 or 6. So, you know, it was always something I wanted. We moved then mainly because of the troubles in the North. Moved over in 72 to England. He managed to stud then in Gloucestershire. And then we moved to Newmarket. And once I was in Newmarket, that was it, really. I was able to start riding out age sort of 11, 12 in stables in Newmarket. And the obsession grew from there.
It's fascinating the troubles compelled you to move, because obviously, you know, we in the South, we had this idea of the troubles, and I suppose the time you mentioned was almost at the height of it, but it obviously was a serious issues such that you actually couldn't even live there anymore.
It was getting really hard for Dad, crossing the border all the time with the horses, and late back at night, and I just remember one, or Mum goes on about it a lot, but we were driving back one night and we basically came over the hill, saw Newry below us, and it just looked as if it was totally ablaze. And I think that was one of the little things that contributed to us moving. There was another factor. My mother's parents, who lived in England, they weren't in great health also, so she was also urging that we might head back over to England.
It's funny, I was reading bits of your first book where you're talking about your identity, and I think anybody who, my parents left the North because of the troubles in 77. They spent a year in Bath in England and then moved to the South, and I definitely would have been fairly conflicted as a teenager, like where am I actually from, like what is my identity, where is it? You know, I would have supported the Northern Ireland team in the 86 World Cup, and my friends would have looked at me going, what are you doing, this isn't our team, this is a different team. I was like, what are you talking about, they're an Ireland team playing in green, of course they're my team. What was that like for you growing up as a teenager in England? Because there's a great bit in your book where you're talking about going to the first Six Nations game with Ireland, England, Twickenham. And there's no doubt in your mind that you are Irish because you want that Ireland team to win that day.
Yeah, I've always grown up that way. I'm Irish, got an Irish passport. It's never been a big thing for me. Anyone asks where I'm from, I'm from Ireland. So that's, and Irish rugby team is represented by all four, and you know, so it's never been, as I say, big thing as far as I'm concerned.
To be honest, Richard, I'm more intrigued by Ger's identity crisis at this stage.
Yeah, that's probably it.
Never revealed before. It had to take the COVID-19 and Skype for him to finally come
to
out.
To find
the
out, yeah, yeah. Good to know now. You'll fire that back at him a few times.
Yeah, exactly. I was interested though, because Robbie Keane, when he was asked about leaving Wolves to go to Coventry, was leaving Coventry to go to Inter. Everybody at the time was like, "Oh, you know, you're leaving, this is a big move for you. He's like, well, I'm from Tala, I've already moved. So for you to like travel around the world and to end up in Spain, it's not the first time you've moved in your life. I guess that is something that, you know, you have in your armor. You can move, you can make a home wherever you want.
Yeah. Again, since I retired, I've been able to visit interesting places. I've spent almost a year in Paris doing a course that I've been doing a bit of photography over the last few years, and spent a year there. Really enjoyed Paris. Been in Berlin for 9 months. That's a great city as well. So, but now we moved to Spain, and I think we'll stay here for the time being. It's a great country. Madrid is a lovely city. Whether we actually stay in the city is convenient with Millie's education. The schools are great here as well. So at the moment we look set.
Let's go back to racing then. And when did you realize that you were actually going to be good enough to be one of the very best jockeys? Because there must be some point in your life where that clearly becomes an ambition. For a lot of people, it's an ambition, but they don't actually make it. So at some point you're up against your peers and you realize, actually, I've got something here. I'm going to be better than these guys. I've got something that they don't.
I was driven. People say there's no the top sports and they don't have a fear of failure. But certainly that was, I find that a real driver all the way through my career. And I don't think I ever sort of reached that stage until probably I won the championship the first time. And I remember getting the call from Robert Kington, who was Peter Scudamore's brother-in-law, the morning. He said, you know, basically, Scoo's retiring today. Well done. You're going to be champion jockey. And I still didn't believe him after Scoo had even retired that afternoon, but made it that year. And yeah, then you know, all you're looking forward, all you have to do is be champion jockey again. Managed to do that another couple of times. And then just try and continue on the top of your game for as long as you possibly can.
You do seem to be somebody who is driven on by rivalry, that actually helped bring out the best in you. The rivalry with Adrian Maguire in particular is something that is the focus of a long kind of series of elements of the book. Was that important to you? Was that kind of outside motivation something that actually made sense to you? It was like, this is a race for us to get as many winners as we can. It's very easy to understand. It's very easy to get up in the smallest meeting suddenly becomes important.
Yeah, it was a hard, really, really tough year for the both of us. Basically, the story was that I'd left David Nicholson to join Martin Pipe, you know, number one trainer, champion trainer so many times. And basically, I'd left the Duke, who had a great job, great relationship with, left him to go to Martin Pipe's to be champion jockey. Halfway through the season, Adrian Maguire had taken my job at David Nicholson's, was 40-odd winners clear of me. Things weren't going very well. And basically I had to give it all for that last 3, 4, 5 months of the season to ride as many winners as I possibly could and try and catch Adrian. And luckily, Martin's horses, who had been suffering from a virus, they turned around, they came into form during the spring. And despite getting a stupid ban, nearly put Adrian through a wing or the other side of a wing.
At Nottingham, I believe.
In a race at Nottingham, Mr. Genealogy, he was riding. I was able to get in front of him and then just hang on those last couple of days.
Was there a kind of an element of the maverick genius about Martin Pipe, or what was he like to work with?
Obviously the genius, maverick genius, as you say, but he really did. He worked very hard, and that was as much a key to his success as anything else. He also was always looking at finding that extra edge wherever it came from, other sports, blood testing his horses' bloods, keeping them, the interval training he was doing on a short, reasonably short gallop. He was certainly ahead of his game. He knew how to get his horses fit. He knew how to place his horses to win races.
And were you kind of conscious of how many people seemed to idolize you, who later became jockeys like Segerity and so on, and how, I suppose, maybe you redefined style in terms of what it was like to be a jockey who was, you know, top level, but also obviously champion jockey as well?
Yeah, I don't look at myself, but I looked at Frankham and basically how John Frankham was an amazing jockey as I was growing up, and was very extremely stylish, brilliant over a fence, presented his horses very well, used to show jump, and, you know, it was just a different ball game. So, and then also I suppose riding out in Newmarket, was riding out with a lot of flat jockeys, so I was trying to take a little bit of more of my star maybe from the flat side a little bit. So, you know, but at the end of the day, it was, while I was riding, it was just trying to eliminate those mistakes as much as I possibly could.
How did you do that?
It's a lot of it's focus. You say, you talk about what made AP great, and he would say it's as much up there in the mind as anything. And it was in your mind, focus all the time, and being on top of your game. Yeah, never mind your skill, your physical ability to do something. It's as much in the mind as anything else, I think.
Is that exhausting after a period of time, or do you get good at it? Because when you're talking there, for example, about that battle with Adrian Maguire, where you're 40-odd behind him, do you come alive in that moment? Do you feel alive? Is that the whole point of giving everything, and all the sacrifices that you make, and all the books you read, and all the people you speak to, and all the practice and hours that you put in? Is like, right, here's the race, I'm 40 behind, let's get going.
Yeah, you're all the time, day in, day out. It's very different racing. It's very different from other sports. You know, football, you build yourself up, maybe, okay, Wednesday or Thursday, and then again on a Saturday or Sunday, maybe only twice a week. We're having to do it 7 days a week, maybe six races a day. It's hard to maintain that and maintain your form through a season. Back then, it was 10 months of the year. Now the lads are riding, you know, 12 months and nearly every day. And to maintain that level of performance all the time is very, very difficult. And you get falls, you get hurt, you lose your confidence a little bit through the season, but it's a matter of just trying to get it back again. And you know, you'll lose your confidence. You won't see a stride. We say one fall, winners lead to winners, but falls also lead to more falls. I always find that you get on a run, you start seeing a bad stride, and you put horses on the floor that shouldn't fall. It's all part of being a jockey, and also of being a champion jockey. AP will tell you the same, I'm sure.
It's obviously not that long ago you were riding, but I mean, watching back your racing TV interview with Thomas Stanley, it was just remarkable that, I think, was it that you went to see a kind of a psychiatrist just about your jockey life or whatever, and it was quickly seized upon by one of the tabloids.
Certainly did that time when I joined Pipey. Things weren't going too well. I think it was Michael Caulfield, who now is one of the top sports psychologists in England. He was manager of the Jockey Association then, and having had a word with him, he said, why don't you go and have a word with a guy called Peter Terry, who was one of the number one sports psychologists, worked with some of the Olympic teams. And I have to say, talking with Peter, those sessions certainly for me made the difference.
You was probably well ahead of your time in that regard. I wouldn't have thought it would have been common at the time for jockeys.
I think I was, because I think it was, as you say, you refer to the headlines there. I think it was in the Sun that they said that it was off my rocker, basically.
But, what was the headline again?
I think it was done. They were saying Dun Goody had done this when I'd had a few winners. It was Dun Maddie when I was off to the sports psychologist.
Remarkable when you think about it.
It is now, yeah. It is one. You know, a lot of the jockeys would certainly use them, and you know, in most sport, if not every sport.
It's intriguing as well, because Dr. Adrian McGoldrick, before he left the Turf Club role, would have found a massive incidence of depressive tendencies among jockeys. And, you know, obviously we've had Mark Enright on the show and all that, but it's remarkable that, I suppose, for so long, you know, if you had a headline like that, and this was obviously a long time ago, that jockeys who may have been struggling and it's a tough road had to kind of suffer in silence, and they couldn't exactly man up and admit it.
Yeah, as I say, you go physically, you go up and down through a season, but mentally you can as well. You can get into some really dark places. You're not having a good run, and you really need that support, and it's fantastic now that jockeys are able to receive that.
Is part of going to run a marathon in North Korea and part of going to the South Pole hunting for the adrenaline of what it was like to win a Gold Cup or a national or a champion hurdle? Is there a connection in these two things?
I was going to say South Pole, there wasn't too much, unless we did end up one day in a middle the middle of the middle of a crevasse field, but that was about the only time the adrenaline flowed. But the rest of the time, it was just one pure slog heading down there. No, people say that are looking for adrenaline buzz, but it's not really. It's just what's been presented, you know, what's come up. And I say, keep repeating that I've just been very lucky to have had these opportunities, and it's been fantastic to been able to take them.
Do you miss, like you talked about missing the weight room, and that camaraderie seems to be something that everybody who comes out of big time sport. What about the actual victories themselves? Because, you know, your list of massive individual one-off occasions that you won, there's a Grand National, another Grand National, Champion Hurdle, Gold Cup, Irish Grand National, loads of wins at the Cheltenham Festival as well. Is there something specific about the act of winning a big race that is actually something you can put your finger on and go, I really miss that? Or are they one-off occasions in your life that you just have to celebrate at the time? Because you know there isn't going to be 6 million of the feeling that you get when you win a Gold Cup.
That's it. There's nothing come anywhere close to that since I've retired. And it's quite funny, you remind about AP always says to me, what do you want to run for? You're never going to win a race. What do you want to enter something like that? I run and enter these things now just to enjoy it, and you compete against yourself. But no, it's something, it's the best part of our lives, you know, to ride winners, to go and ride winners at Cheltenham, or to be lucky enough to ride a Grand National winner. You are never ever going to come close to it. And I have to say again how very lucky I've been.
The one last question that I wanted to ask you about was when you're trying to recover your form, because this is the kind of the holy grail for all sports people, and bottle in particular is a subject that comes up again and again on this show, particularly when we talk to the jockeys about, oh look, when I lose my bottle, I know it's going to be time to go. But from listening to you, it sounds like there are times within the season where you can feel it slipping away. There are times probably on a day where you can feel it slipping away after a bad race. How did you wrestle that back, and how much of a job is it to wrestle it back?
That's very true. Yeah, so you're up and down through the season. You might get three really hammering fours. You might be going out with an injury. You shouldn't really be riding, probably, but you have to carry that injury. You have to keep going. Other jockeys are going to get in your horses and steal your rides if you don't go out and ride them. I always find that the one way, the best way to get that confidence back a bit was to get a real hard fall and just walk away from it, and you know, be lucky enough to walk away from it and not hurt, and that always I felt was as big a confidence builder as actually riding a few winners.
Because it gave you a sense that somehow you were fated to go on and do well?
Yeah, that, you know, you could just get away with anything. You know, having had a pile driver into the ground, and you walk away from it, you feel invincible. And that, in one way, was as good as any as say, getting that confidence back.
And when you came to the end, was it a horrible feeling that, you know, I have to move on to the next stage? Was there a feeling that you were kind of, I don't know, you were imprisoned by the future, or did you embrace it?
I say it was with my neck injury, and it sort of like it was affecting my right arm. So it was a long, sort of slow process. It was over that last year. It dragged on, and you know, that injury really was very hard to cope with, because it was not something that was, it was a definite thing. I had to go to so many doctors. I had to consult doctors in Ireland, doctors in America, to get that sort of, this is the end. It wasn't as decisive as I would have loved it to have been. And ideally, I would have loved to have ridden until I was 40, if I ever could have done another 5 or 6 years anyway. So, yeah, it was hard. That last year was quite tough.
And probably your body and mind saying to you, okay, you've had enough, you've got out the other side, and you're not unscathed, but you're going to be free to be able to do what it is that you want to do in the second part of your life.
Yep, and at the same time, how lucky we are. And you see all the really bad injuries in racing that have occurred to the lads. And you know, it's really, really tough to see that. But you have to appreciate that to get out and to be fit and to be able to go and do a 10K every Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning. You know, again, it's. We're very fortunate to be able to do those things.
Well, look, you're an inspiration to all of us, and I wish you and everybody in Madrid the very best. Richard, you've been great with your time. Thanks very much for joining us this week. There's only one thing left for me to do, and that's to tell everybody that with no Irish Racing to have a punt on at the moment, Tote are going to donate the usual €100 stake directly to our Tote Irish Injured Jockeys Fund. And it says here, as it can take Johnny over 10 weeks to pick a winner, this not backing horses could work out well for everybody. That's a bit of a dig there, Johnny, but you know, you can't really argue with the logic of it. This Sunday does see some high-class.
That's a bit of a dig. That's digging a gravesite, I think, to be fair. Terrible stuff.
High-class graded racing from Hong Kong, including the prestigious Group 2 Sprint Cup and Chairman's Trophy, you can bet on and live stream Hong Kong racing on thetote.com. Friday Night Racing is brought to you in association with Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie or follow the new Twitter account at HRI Racing. Again, thanks to our guest this week, Richard Dunwoody, for being so generous with his time from Madrid. That's it for this week. We'll see you next week at 3 o'clock on all of our social channels on offtheball.com and, of course, on Friday evening on Off the Ball on Newstalk. Take care.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.